Welcome to another Salvation by Grace midweek message. Salvation by Grace is the teaching ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. You'll find us on the internet at salvationbygrace.org. We are currently studying the minor prophets of the Old Testament. So grab your Bible and join the congregation of GCA, along with our teaching pastor, Jim McClarty.
Turn to Joel chapter 2. Joel chapter 2 begins with a trumpet. There are actually two trumpets in this chapter, in verse 1 and in verse 15. They both have different purposes. The first one is an alarm to let the people know that there is trouble coming, invading armies are coming. And in chapter 15, it's to gather the people to declare a fast and a solemn fast before God. And it says, blow the trumpet in Zion and sound an alarm on my holy mountain, and let all the inhabitants of the land tremble, for the day of the Lord is coming. Surely it is near. That's our introduction for this evening, because last week we did talk a good deal about the day of the Lord. And in introducing Joel in the first chapter, he described a locust attack that wiped out everything in front of it and left nothing behind it. And I told you that that was an actual event that took place that Joel is recounting, but then he is using that as a comparison to what is coming, where the armies of God are going to sweep across the country and are going to leave nothing in their wake. But I also told you that he doesn't name any specific army. In fact, what he ends up saying is that it's an army unlike any army has ever been. He even says that it is an army that God himself has assembled. And that should sound familiar because that is language that we have seen from the other prophets. And we even see in the book of Revelation with the idea of Gog and Magog and the gathering of the armies of the nations to go fight against Israel. And the book of Revelation says that it is God preparing a feast for the birds, that the birds of the air will come and feast on the flesh of captains and kings. So this is consistent language that Joel is laying out here in talking about the day of the Lord. Now, you might recall that last week, when we were sort of defining and explaining the day of the Lord, that Susan in particular said that she had always been under the impression that the day of the Lord was a time of trouble, a time of judgment, a time of darkness. And as we are expanding our understanding of the day of the Lord, I said that it also included a time of restoration, the reestablishment of Israel, the regathering of the tribes back to their land, and the establishment of the kingdom, that all of that fell under the big heading of the day of the Lord. And we're going to see that here in chapter 2. In fact, Joel is going to, while talking about the day of the Lord, describe how God makes a distinction between the nations of the earth who are in fact going to fall under this judgment of his, and yet at the same time, it's going to be a judgment for Israel that ends in a restoration for Israel. So while it ends in judgment and destruction and annihilation for the nations that come up against Israel, it ends in restoration for Israel. And that is actually thematic to more than just Joel. It is an idea that comes up repeatedly through the other prophets. So I want to take the next couple of minutes and talk about Day of the Lord again and look at what some of the other prophets have to say about it, see what Jesus has to say about it so that we can continue expanding our notion and understanding of what the Day of the Lord is. And then in whatever minutes are left when we get done with that, we will look at Joel in chapter 2. Chapter 2, by the way, does close with the very language that Peter does pick up on the day of Pentecost. We won't get to that until next week. Hopefully, we'll get more than just one verse out of Joel 2 tonight, but no promises, really. So I said that the day of the Lord is the day of God's vengeance against his enemies and against the enemies of Israel, but that it is also a time of restoration for Israel. For instance, Obadiah, starting in verse 15, says, "For the day of Yahweh," Yom Yahweh, the day of the Lord, "for the day of Yahweh draws near on all the nations." So the Gentile nations are included in this time of judgment and God's outpouring of power. "The day draws near on all the nations. And as you have done, it will be done to you. Your dealings will return on your own head. Because just as you all drank on my holy mountain, all the nations will drink continually. They will drink and swallow, and they will be as if they never were." In other words, it's God's way of saying, you have come to my holy mountain. You have come to Jerusalem. You have conquered. You have fought against my people. And the same way that you celebrated and drank on my holy mountain, I'm now going to bring that same thing, those same events down on you, and the end result is going to be that it is as if you never were. But on Mount Zion, there will be those who escape, and it, Mount Zion, will be holy, and the house of Jacob will possess their possessions. Then the house of Jacob will be as a fire, and the house of Joseph will be as a flame, but the house of Esau will be as stubble. Stubble burns, and it's going to burn before the house of Jacob, before Israel. So Israel, after the punishment of God, is going to be the weapon of God in order to punish the house of Esau. Now, not to get too internationally specific here, but who is the house of Esau? It's the Arabs. All the Arab nations are direct descendants of the house of Esau, which is why this past week, when President Trump was in Israel, he then went to Egypt. On the same day, both Egypt and Israel both gave him the highest honor and highest award, even though they are ancient enemies. And Netanyahu referred to both those groups as the children of Abraham, because they are all descendants of either Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, or their descendants through Esau. And the Arab nations and the Israelite nations have been fighting ever since. Well, the prediction here is that God is ultimately going to use the house of Jacob as a fire and Joseph as a flame, but the house of Esau is going to be as stubble. So clearly, many of the nations that are responsible for attacking Israel, especially in the build-up to those last days and that final conflagration, are going to include the Arab nations. And as we look at world geopolitics to this very day, we can see that happening, because they are the first and foremost enemies of Israel, even at this moment. So then the house of Jacob will be a fire, and the house of Joseph will be a flame, but the house of Esau will be as stubble, and they will set them on fire and consume them, so that there will be no survivor for the house of Esau, for Yahweh has spoken. Okay, now what I really want you to see there in Obadiah, from 15 to 18, is that God drew a distinction between those that are his people in the house of Israel and those, the descendants of the nations, the Gentile nations, particularly the descendants of Esau. And he said that while he was in the enterprise of punishing the enemies of Israel and all the nations, the Gentile nations that had come against his holy mountain. At the same time, there's going to be those who escape of Israel, and that they will be, and the land will be holy, and the house of Jacob will possess their possessions. So at the same time that the day of the Lord is bringing about punishment on the nations, it's also bringing about restoration to Israel. And Joel is going to say the same thing. Meanwhile, Zephaniah, I'm in chapter 1, starting to read in verse 7, it says, "Be silent before the Lord Yahweh, for the day of Yahweh, the day of the Lord, is near. For Yahweh, God himself, has prepared a sacrifice. He has set apart his guests. Then it will be on the day of Yahweh's sacrifice that I will punish the princes and the king's sons and all who clothe themselves in foreign garments. And I will punish on that day all who leap on the temple threshold, who fill the house of the Lord with violence and deceit. And it will be in that day, declares Yahweh, that there will be a sound of a cry from the fish gate and a wail from the second quarter and a great destruction from the hills." All of that is language of God punishing Israel for the way they have betrayed him, how they have chased after other gods, how they have become like the foreign nations and have put on the garments of the foreign nations so that they are no longer singularly and wholly righteous people of God. But then starting in verse 14, it says, "Near is the great day of the Lord, near and coming very quickly. Oh, the sound, the day of Yahweh. In it, the mighty man cries out bitterly. A day of fury is that day, a day of trouble and distress, a day of destruction and desolation, a day of darkness and of thick darkness, a day of clouds and dense gloom, a day of trumpet and loud shouting against the fortified cities and the high corner towers. And I will bring distress on men so that they will walk like the blind because they have sinned against Yahweh, and their blood will be poured out like dust and their flesh like dung, and neither their silver nor their gold will be able to deliver them on the day of the fury of Yahweh. And all the earth will be devoured in the fire of his jealousy, and he will make a complete destruction, indeed a terrifying one, of all the inhabitants of the earth." Isaiah 13 picks up that language in verse 6. "Wail, for the day of the Lord is near. It will come as destruction from the Almighty, and therefore all hands will fall limp, and every man's heart will melt, and they will be terrified. Pains and anguish will take hold of them. They will writhe like a woman in labor, and they will look at one another in astonishment, their faces aflame. Behold, the day of the Lord is coming, cruel with fury and burning anger, to make the land a desolation, and he will exterminate its sinners from us. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not flash forth their light. The sun will be dark when it rises, and the moon will not shed its light. And thus I will punish the world for its evil, and the wicked for their iniquity. And I will also put an end to the arrogance of the proud, and I will abase the haughtiness of the ruthless. I will make a mortal man scarcer than pure gold. I will make mankind scarcer than the gold of Ophir. Therefore, I shall make the heavens tremble, and the earth will be shaken from its place, and the fury of the Lord of hosts in that day will be his burning anger." So clearly, this time of trouble against the nations, this time of punishment and judgment from God is against the nations of the earth, but it is against Israel. Notice the language. It's always starting at Israel. It's always starting at Jerusalem. It's starting with the people of God. And then ultimately, it branches out to all the earth, and yet in the midst of all that punishment and judgment from God, that great fury, that day of darkness, even the celestial disturbances that are happening. Nevertheless, God still keeps making this distinction between the whole world and his people Israel. Malachi 4, you know this passage, at least you should. It's the very end of the Old Testament. For behold, the day is coming, burning like a furnace, and all the arrogant and every evildoer will be chaff. And the day that is coming will set them ablaze, says the Lord of hosts, so that I will leave them neither root nor branch. But for you who fear my name, the Son of Righteousness will rise with healing in its wings, and you will go forth, and you will skip about like calves from a stall. There's a huge contrast in language. To all the nations of the earth, there's nonstop judgment like a furnace that is coming, that is going to burn the evildoers like chaff. Judgment from God unlike anything that has ever been, anything that anybody has ever imagined, God pouring out his fury. And yet, there will be those people who belong to him. And of course, in context, Malachi is writing to Israel specifically. But for you who fear my name, the Son of Righteousness will rise with healing in its wings. And you will go forth and skip about like calves from a stall, and you will tread down the wicked, for they will be ashes under the soles of your feet on the day which I am preparing, says the Lord of hosts. Remember the law of Moses, my servant, even the statutes and ordinances which I commanded him in Horeb for all Israel. Behold, I'm going to send you, specifically you, I'm going to send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of that great and terrible day of the Lord. And he will restore the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to the fathers, so that I will not come and smite the land with a curse. God, one more time, makes this enormous distinction between his judgment against all the nations and all his enemies, all the people who have ever fought against Israel, all the sinners of this world, and at the same time keeps saying, but then there's Israel, and I'm even going to send them their great prophet before the great and terrible day of the Lord. And he's going to restore them, and he's going to turn their hearts. Remember what we've already read in the book of Zechariah. That when Christ comes back, and by the way, his coming back, as we're going to see in a moment, is right along with the celestial disturbances that we just read out of Isaiah. So all of this ties together into this big eschatological picture of what God intends to do at the end. But the entirety of that eschatology is following the blueprint that we've been following for weeks and weeks. When Moses spoke to the children of Israel and told them exactly what to expect in their future, which was that they were going to be scattered, and that they were going to be punished, and that they were going to be restored. And just because this day of great darkness and gloom and God's fury is coming, it doesn't change the fact that God is going to accomplish everything that he promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and that means the ultimate restoration of Israel. Now, that entire event, everything I've been reading about so far, this time of trouble and darkness and gloom and punishment, might very well be the same thing that John was describing in the book of Revelation. For instance, in Revelation 16, starting at verse 13, I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon and out of the mouth of the beast and out of the mouth of the false prophet three unclean spirits like frogs. And they are the spirits of demons performing signs, which go out to the kings of the whole world to gather them together for the war of the great day of God the Almighty. Behold, I am coming like a thief. Blessed is he that stays awake and keeps his garments, lest he walk about naked and men see his shame. And he gathered them together to a place which in the Hebrew is called Har-Mageddon, which is where we get the word Armageddon, from the valley of Megiddo, the plain in Megiddo, where this final conflagration is going to take place. All of that is in the context of blow a trumpet in Zion, sound an alarm on my holy mountain, let all the inhabitants of the land tremble, for the day of the Lord is coming. Surely it is near. It is a day of darkness and of gloom, a day of clouds and thick darkness. As the dawn is spread over the mountains, so there is a great and a mighty people. And there has never been anything like it, nor will there be again after it to many, many generations. A fire consumes before them, and behind them a flame burns, and the land in front of them is like the Garden of Eden, but the desolate wilderness is behind them, and nothing at all escapes them. Their appearance is like the appearance of horses. They are like war horses, and that's how they run. With a noise as of chariots, they leap from the tops of the mountains like the crackling of a flame of fire consuming all the stubble. There's that language again. That burning, that stubble, that destruction. And it is God who is assembling an army, unlike an army than anyone has ever seen. So whether we're looking at Revelation and the gathering of all the kings of the earth and their armies to bring them to Armageddon, or whether we're talking about Joel 2, there is this description of a final battle that is going to take place, but that God, who is sovereign, is in control of the entirety of the battle because he is the one that is gathering all the kings of the earth to come there and be ultimately destroyed by the power of God because of their hatred and fighting against Israel while he is protecting and restoring his people Israel. Have I lost anybody yet?
No.
All I want you to see is how consistent this is. That's why I'm reading from several different minor prophets and one major, Isaiah, and then Revelation, and then Joel, because they're all saying the same thing. The Bible only tells one story. And the story over and over again is that God is going to punish the peoples of this earth while making distinctions of Israel, his people. Got it? Okay. We're also talking about what Peter is referring to, because he talks about a final cataclysm, a final conflagration, a final burning. He uses the same language that is so very similar to everything else we've seen so far. 2 Peter 3:10, but the day of the Lord will come like a thief, which just means it comes suddenly, it comes unexpectedly, in which the heavens will pass away with a roar and the elements of this earth will be destroyed with an intense heat and the earth and its works will be burned up. It's the same language we're seeing here in Joel. This final burning and that the armies will be like chaff before him. Back to Joel 2 then. At verse 5, with a noise as of chariots, they leap from the tops of the mountains like the crackling of a flame of fire consuming the stubble, like a mighty people arranged for battle. Before them, the people are in anguish. All faces turn pale. They run like mighty men. They climb the wall like soldiers, and they each march in line. Nor do they deviate from their paths. They do not crowd each other. They march everyone in his path, and they burst through the defenses. He's describing an army that is so well disciplined that they will stay in regimen, they will stay in line, they'll stay in formation as they march through all the other armies, the other cities, all their enemies, and just mow down everything in their path. They do not break ranks. They rush on the city. They run on the wall. They climb into the houses. They enter through the windows like a thief. And before them, the earth quakes. And the heavens tremble. And the sun and the moon grow dark. And the stars lose their brightness. Does that sound familiar? Because this day of the Lord language is when God unleashes his anger and his wrath on the sinful people of the planet. He starts with Israel because of their refusal to follow him, but then his punishment encompasses all the inhabitants of the earth for their mistreatment of his chosen people. And in a time of darkness and distress and fear and anguish, it's a time of torment at the hand of God. It's a time of judgment and a time of punishment. But according to Joel and the others that we are reading, it's ultimately the time of restoration for Israel. And we're going to see that before we're done here tonight. But then Peter quotes from Joel, probably to remind them that the prophecy is still good and still forthcoming, that Jesus didn't abolish the law and the prophets. Like he said, he was here to guarantee their fulfillment. And so, quoting from Joel 2:30, which we haven't gotten to yet, Peter says, "And I will grant wonders in the sky above and signs on the earth below, blood and fire and vapor of smoke. The sun will be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and terrible glorious day of the Lord shall come." So Peter, on the day of Pentecost, talks about the day of the Lord to come, and he talks about the celestial disturbances that Joel is talking about as part of the invading armies, the destruction that is coming. And then Jesus himself picks it up and talks about how this is a forthcoming reality. Matthew 24:29, "But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light and the stars will fall." By the way, that's also quoted in Isaiah 34:4. So this is the consistent testimony of the prophets of the Old Testament, and then Jesus confirms that it's still a future reality, that the stars will fall from the sky and the powers of the heaven will be shaken. But as part and parcel of all those celestial events, and as part and parcel of the day of the Lord and the time of judgment, Jesus adds, "And the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn." Yeah, that's what we've been reading. "And they will see the Son of Man coming on clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, a gathering call, just like we've been seeing. And they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other." That's that regathering of Israel that we've been reading about all the way along. So the prophets all say the same thing. There's this time of trouble such as never was or ever would be again, and it's coming. Daniel talks about it, Jeremiah talks about it, Jesus talks about it, and calls it the time of trouble such as never was or ever will be again. Jesus talks about the day of the Lord, just like the Old Testament prophets talk about the day of the Lord, that it is a time of judgment, but then it is also a time of promise and restoration for Israel. Jesus talks about that, as we're going to see in a moment. And then Joel also tells us, as Isaiah does, that in that ultimate time of trouble, there are going to be what I keep calling celestial disturbances, where the sun's going to go dark and the stars are going to fall and the powers of heaven are going to be shaken. But then Jesus says, when all that is happening, then he himself comes back, because he is part of that ultimate judgment. That's when he is going to return. But then you connect that with Zechariah, and the return of Christ comes, and they look on him whom they have pierced and weep as a woman weeps over her only son. So again, there's distinction. He's coming back to judge the nations of the earth, but it's also a time of Israel's restoration when they look on him and see him as their Messiah, because God gives them that spirit of supplication and that spirit of repentance before him. So we're just putting all these pieces together. For years now, we've been reading all these different prophets who are all saying these distinct individual things. And all I'm trying to do tonight is pull them into one basket and say, look how these all fit together. They're all saying, and this is the hand motion for how they all fit together, because the Bible keeps telling this one story, that this day is coming, this day when there's going to be an army unlike any army we've ever seen on earth, that it is God himself who is going to gather them. And that's talked about in Joel 2 and is talked about in Revelation. And they are going to be gathered together for the Armageddon, for the final cataclysmic battle. And God is going to pour out punishment that starts at Israel and corrects his people, just like the blueprint says. But then it is going to extend to the nations of the earth that have ever fought against Israel, all the enemies of God, and then the restoration of Israel as he makes all of their enemies nothing in front of them. And in the midst of all that, Christ is here setting up his kingdom. All those pieces fit together. Do you see the jigsaw puzzle? Mm-hmm. Do you see how it all fits together? Have I lost anybody yet? Now, let me add one more little wrinkle here, because on our Sunday morning harmonization of the Gospels, we haven't gotten to Matthew 24 yet. When we do finally, and this is just God's good providential timing, we will have all of this Old Testament prophetic teaching in place, and I think that's going to make Matthew 24 much more understandable as a result, because Jesus doesn't say anything that hasn't already been predicted by the prophets. He's just confirming all the stuff that they said. But let me bring up one particular phrase that I've made videos about, and it is a point of great contention out there in the theological world that I just don't think is all that difficult. But it is Matthew 24, 34, and really, if you know the blueprint, if you know all the stuff that the prophets have said, Matthew 24, 34 falls right in line with. Jesus is simply confirming what the blueprint says, what all the prophets say about the ultimate restoration of Israel. All that it says is, truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. And there are people who say, well, what that means is this, and they'll say that's a near demonstrative pronoun in the Greek, this generation, which means the people alive at the time that Jesus said it, and that's about a 40-year time span, and so all these things that he has predicted, the time of trouble such as never was, the Antichrist coming, all the things that he talks about, all have to be wrapped up by the end of 40 years from when he said it, because that's this generation. However, the Greek word is genea. And as I'll show you when we do finally get to Matthew 24, the word genea is used a lot in the New Testament. And much of the time that it's used, it is clearly talking about people groups, people of a common genetic descent, which is why our English word, genealogy, to this day, has genea right at the front of it. It hasn't even changed. G-E-N-E-A, which are the anglicized letters that spell genea, pronounced genea in Greek. If you are looking at Matthew 24, 34 in like the NASB or any of the modern translations, you'll see a footnote that says, or race. Because that's exactly what it means. It means a race of people. When Jesus said, this generation, this genea will not pass, when he's using a near demonstrative pronoun, it means the people he's talking to, who are all Jews, as we'll see in Matthew 24, and he says, this race of people will not disappear just because all of this stuff happens. All this bad stuff, the Antichrist stuff, all this stuff of the conflagration to come, all these armies, this time of trouble such as never was or ever would be again. All that stuff's going to happen, but don't worry, this people group will not pass away until all these things do take place. In other words, he's confirming what we know as the blueprint, which is that Israel is going to survive all that. He's confirming what Jeremiah says when he says that the time of trouble such as never was or ever would be again is the time of Jacob's trouble, and then he adds, but he'll get through it. He will survive it. Jesus is simply stating the exact same thing, that all these things are going to happen, but this people group will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth, he says, will pass away, That's very much like what Peter said, that it's all going to be burned up and God's going to make a new heaven and a new earth. But my words will not pass away, and that includes his promise that this people group will not be done away with despite this time of trouble such as never was or ever would be again. Jesus is saying the same thing Revelation is saying. He's saying the same thing the prophets have said. He's saying the same thing Joel is saying. It all fits together. Okay, then back to Joel. Joel chapter 2, starting in verse 11. Notice that God, Yahweh, calls this great army, such as never was or ever would be again, this army that he himself has assembled and amassed, he calls it his army. The Lord utters his voice. That word utters, I wish, was slightly differently translated. It means he makes his voice known. He pronounces his own voice. He lets people know his voice. And he presents his voice before his own army. And surely his camp is very great. It's a massive camp of people. For strong is he who carries out his own word. That's right. God is very strong in the carrying out of his word. And he's doing all of this because that's exactly what his word said. Ever since the blueprint. Ever since he said to Israel, if you don't follow me, if you chase after other gods, if you intermarry with the other people groups, if you start dressing and acting like the Gentiles, I'll scatter you out of your land and I will punish you. So now he's actually doing all of that. He is carrying out his own word. And the day of the Lord is indeed great and very awesome. And who can endure it? That word awesome there is not like awesome, man. We've reached the point where we've lost the understanding of what that word really means. And we think, you know, that pizza was awesome. But awesome means full of awe, awestruck, dumbfounded by the strength of God pouring out and demonstrating his own power on earth. That day is very great, majestic, awesome, and who can endure it? And yet, now look, I mean, the first part of that chapter, down to verse 11, has all been it's terror and dark and gloom and awesome and terrifying. Verse 12, and yet even now, declares the Lord, return to me with all your heart, and with fasting and weeping and mourning, and rend your hearts and not your garments. Now return to the Lord your God, for he is gracious and compassionate.
He is.
In the midst of gathering armies to destroy the whole earth, in the midst of everything we've been reading about the doom and gloom and darkness of that day, God also says, I'm a gracious God. I'm a compassionate God. And he makes a distinction between those that are his and those that he is destroying. He is a gracious and a compassionate God. He is slow to anger and abounding in loving kindness and relenting of evil. Who knows whether he will not turn and relent and leave a blessing behind him? Even a grain offering and a drink offering for the Lord your God. So, verse 15, here's another trumpet. First it was blow a trumpet in Zion because this great army is coming, this great conflagration. They're going to sweep through the land and leave nothing behind them. But blow a trumpet in Zion and consecrate a fast. Proclaim a solemn assembly. Gather the people. Sanctify the congregation. Assemble the elders, gather the children and the nursing infants, and let the bridegroom come out of his room, and let the bride come out of her bridal chamber. Let the priests, the Lord's ministers, weep before the porch and the altar, and let them all say, spare your people, O Lord, and do not make your inheritance a reproach. Notice the language. Why is he inviting Israel in particular to come and beseech him to relent? Because they are his people. Spare your people, O Yahweh. We are your inheritance. Don't make your inheritance this kind of reproach. Don't make us a byword among the Gentiles and among the nations. Why should all the people say, where is their God? Because after all, if Israel's God is Yahweh, and then Israel is destroyed, it's easy for the naysayers and the critics to say, well, their God must not be very strong, because look, they got wiped out by all these foreign nations. They got wiped out by the children of Esau. They got wiped. Where is your God? So part of the plea is, why would you let your people be a reproach? And why would you let the Gentiles say, where is their God? But then look what happens in verse 8. I think what we've been reading from verse 12 down to verse 17 is Joel as a prophet saying to the people, you know, it's not too late. This is coming. Because we know it's going to happen, change your ways now. Call on God now. Even though he has established this reality as our future, nevertheless, he may still relent. He may still save us. Consecrate fasts, proclaim solemn assemblies, sanctify the congregation. And then plead with him, pray to him. Why would you let the Gentile nations mock you that way? Verse 18, then the Lord will be zealous for his land. Now, why is he going to suddenly have this great zeal and this great compassion and desire for the land of Israel, for the land of Canaan? Why? Because it's his land. No matter how defiled this world becomes, his land continues to be his land. And even as it is defiled, part of the promise is that he's going to make it holy. That's what we saw previously, that he is going to restore the land. He's going to make Zion a holy hill once again, because it does belong to him. And he will have pity on his people. Why? Why is he having pity on these people who he has had, so far at least 3,000 years, of just nothing but trouble from? Everything we've read in Jeremiah, everything we've been reading so far, is just about how guilty Israel is. And yet here's the declaration that in the midst of the day of the Lord, that he's going to have pity on his people, because he is indeed a God who is long-suffering and gracious and compassionate. The Lord will answer and will say to his people, behold, I'm going to send you grain, new wine, and oil, and you will be satisfied in full with them. And I will never again make you a reproach among the nations. Has that happened yet?
No.
Is it a promise from God to Israel?
Absolutely.
It has to happen. It hasn't happened yet. And so it's going to happen within the context of the day of the Lord, the destruction from God the Almighty, this day of gloom and punishment and judgment on the nations of the earth, where he also then begins the restoration of his people, where he's going to give them plenty. He's going to sanctify his land. He's going to give them food to eat and new wine and oil to satisfy them to the full. And no longer will they be a reproach among the nations, but I will remove the northern army far from you. How can he do that? It's his army to begin with. These are the people, the captains, the kings that he has called together to come bring the punishment on them, which means that he can also remove them, which is exactly what he said he's going to do. I will remove the northern army from you, and I will drive it into a parched and a desolate land, and its vanguard, or the front of it, will be at the eastern sea, and the rear guard will be to the western sea, and its stench will arise, and its foul smell will come up, for it has done terrible things. The NASB has it, great things, but again, we've lost the sense of great too. It has done awesome, mighty things, but God is also holding them guilty for the things that they have actually done because they did attack Israel. Let's talk about the sovereignty of God for just a second. I know I do this every time we talk about these kind of events, but I just have to point it out so that nobody misses it. Is it God who brought this army onto Israel?
Yes.
Yes. Was it God who brought the Assyrians down on Israel?
Yes.
Yes. Did God nevertheless hold the Assyrians responsible and punish them for the haughtiness of heart with which they attacked Israel?
He did.
Yes. Is it God who brought the Babylonians down on Judah?
Yes.
Yes. Did he then punish them, just like Jeremiah said that he was going to do, and now they don't even exist as a nation and haven't ever since Babylon was destroyed, despite the fact that there have been leaders over there in the Middle East that have tried to resurrect Babylon again. Nevertheless, God has said it's never again going to be a nation. And so it hasn't ever been. So God can use the Gentiles, the unbelievers, his enemies. He can use them to correct and punish his people and then turn around and punish them for the haughtiness of heart with which they attacked his people, because they're still his people. That's a kind of sovereignty that runs deep and is a kind of sovereignty that is hard for us to wrap our heads around. We got to duct tape our heads closed in order to contain the idea of a God who can say, this is what's going to happen, and then hold people guilty when they do what he said he's going to do with them. Which is why, again, Paul in the Romans letter says, well, then you're going to say to me, how does he then find fault, seeing as how nobody has resisted his will? Paul knows that you're going to ask that question. If God is sovereign and nobody resists his will, how does God then punish people for only doing what he said they were going to do? And of course, you know Paul's answer, which is, who are you to reply against God? Will the thing that was made argue with the one who made it? So this is the kind of God we're talking about. This is the kind of sovereignty that we see all the way through the Bible. God is going to punish that northern army that he assembled, that he brought to the Armageddon, that he brought about the conflagration that is ultimately going to destroy them while protecting Israel. Verse 21, do not fear, O land, his land, Israel. Rejoice and be glad, for the Lord has done great things. It is the exact same word that he said these armies have done great things. I'm going to do even greater things, more awesome things. Do not fear, O land, rejoice and be glad, for the Lord has done great things. Do not fear beasts of the field, for the pastures of the wilderness have turned green. For the tree has borne its fruit. Remember the description at the beginning of this chapter, that when the armies came through, it was like the Garden of Eden in front of them, and behind them, it was nothing. They destroyed everything. Now God is saying, I'm going to restore it. I'm going to restore the land. I'm not just going to restore my people. I'm going to restore my land. The tree has borne its fruit. The fig tree and the vine have yielded in full. So rejoice, O sons of Zion. That is in direct contrast to the fear and the darkness. That day of overwhelming cloud and darkness and panic from people. That when this day of the Lord comes, according to the book of Revelation, that people are going to run for the rocks and the caves and the dens, and they're going to say to the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the wrath of the Lamb. Hide us from the wrath of God. This day of the Lord is terrible, but part of all that is rejoice, O sons of Zion. Rejoice, O sons of Israel, and be glad in the Lord your God, for he has given you the early rain for your vindication, And he has poured down for you the early and the latter rain, just as before. What that means is the big rains in the spring and the rains in the fall, so that you can have two harvests every year, so that you'll have food to eat. And the threshing floors will be full of grain, and the vats will overflow with new wine and oil. And then I will make up to you for the years that the swarming locusts have eaten. And that takes us back to chapter 1. The way that Joel is drawing this connection, where he said there's this actual plague of locusts that actually happened, and that is like a forerunner, like a type of what is ultimately going to happen when these armies come and just sweep through the land and leave nothing behind. God says that I will make up to you everything that these armies have destroyed, these swarms of locusts. I will make up to you the years that the swarming locust has eaten. And then he goes through the same description that Joel described in the first chapter. The creeping locust, the stripping locust, the gnawing locust, my great army which I sent among you. So God says, I'm the one that brought the locusts. I'm the one that brought this great army. I'm the one that assembled them. I'm the one that used them to punish you. But ultimately, I'm going to restore you, and I'm going to punish them. And you will have plenty to eat, and you will be satisfied. And you will praise the name of the Lord your God. How often have we seen this from the prophets, where the ultimate end of everything God is doing with Israel is that they will be his people and he will be their God? That language is consistent among all the prophets. Ultimately, Israel will praise the name of the Lord your God, who has dealt wondrously with you. And then my people will never be put to shame. And thus you will know that I am in the midst of Israel, and that I am Yahweh your God, and there is no other. We've been reading so much about how Israel was taken away from Yahweh and how they brought the sacrifices that belonged to him, and they gave them to the foreign gods and to their idols. God is ultimately going to give them this new heart. He's going to write his law on their heart and in their mind. That's what the new covenant says. And they are going to know him from the least to the greatest. And they're going to know that he is Yahweh, their God, and that there is no other God, and my people will never be put to shame. That's all within the context of the day of the Lord, because it is all an outpouring of the might and the power and the sovereignty of God. Next week, then, we'll start at verse 28, which Peter's going to pick up on the day of Pentecost. And I know that was a whole lot of information that I just dumped on you in one sitting. But I hope if you come away with nothing else, you see the consistency of the entirety of the Bible. And that's why I began, when we were starting looking at the minor prophets, that's why I started by saying, look at the blueprint, understand the blueprint, understand that God has said, this is what I'm going to do. And then the entire rest of the history of the Bible all falls into the categories of that blueprint. And it doesn't matter what prophet you look at, even if you look at Jesus, even if you look at the book of Revelation, what you're seeing is a God who is so sovereign that he can tell you the end from the beginning. And at the beginning, he told Israel exactly what was going to happen to them. And we are in the midst of watching that at this very moment as history continues to unfold over there in the Middle East. And we know what the ultimate end is going to be, because we do have the Bible that tells us what God is going to do. And it is really good to know that a God that is willing to pour out his wrath, who is willing to judge, who's willing to pour out that kind of fury, who has that omnipotent power behind him to punish eternally, that God is also a long-suffering and a gracious God who is able to make distinctions between those that are not his and those that are his. And the ones that are his elect, the ones that are his people, the ones that are chosen before the foundation of the world, he is going to protect and, in fact, is going to bless even as he is in the enterprise of destroying his enemies. I like a God who can make those kind of distinctions, because you don't have to fear the wrath of God. As Paul said, we're not appointed to wrath. We're appointed to the redemption that Jesus Christ has established for us. But that same God is one day going to judge this evil, wicked world that seems to be getting more evil and more wicked with every single passing day. But he knows, and he knows what he's doing. I say, trust that God.
Amen.
Got it?
Grace, grace, grace.
Grace and grace and grace. Wow, I talked a lot. But I got it all in. Comments, feedback, interpretative dance.
I do have some, yeah. Not interpretive dance, but...
Oh, comments. We were all excited about the interpretive dance possibility.
Yeah. You mentioned God being sovereign over the enemies of Israel, bringing them against them, and then intervening in the same way that he did with Assyria and Israel at that time. And I very much see that event with Assyria as a kind of a prototype or picture of the day of the Lord, because here you have this great enemy and that was conquering all the whole region. There was nobody stopping them, and even came into Israel, Assyria, and captured all the other cities and came down against Jerusalem and surrounded Jerusalem. And it was only God intervening with the angel of the Lord, slaying, what is it, 180,000?
Yeah, sent an angel and killed him in one night.
And so that was like a picture of the day of the Lord, because that's the same thing that's going to happen at the end. You know,
that's
you see these enemies come against Israel, it's going to look very bleak, and it's going to look like they're going to be cut off, and there's going to be no answer, and the Lord is going to intervene with the day of the Lord, and he's going to save them. As Isaiah says, like, unless the Lord of hosts had given us some survivors, we would have been cut off.
Absolutely.
Like Sodom and Gomorrah. And that's what would happen. But it's his graciousness and his sovereignty that intervenes with his wrath to save his people and establish them forever.
I like that comment very much, because once you start going down this way of thinking and understanding, it just keeps coming. More Bible keeps coming. And oh yeah, Isaiah said. And oh yeah, this is like Assyria. And oh yeah, on your way home, you'll be thinking of more examples of it, because this is what the Bible says consistently all the way through. Mm-hmm. He's a very consistent God who's telling a story, and it's a very consistent story.
Yeah.
And he's using human history to tell that story.
Yeah.
So, yeah, good comment. Okay, April, this is the second time now you can say he's right. So, there. This past Sunday, she admitted he was right. And we were very excited about it.
It was Wednesday 2 weeks ago.
It was Wednesday 2 weeks ago.
But who's counting?
But I'm glad somebody was, you know, keeping track.
Thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace midweek message. We encourage you to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. for books, articles, and our ever-expanding archive of audio sermons. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.